and from Time Lord...
The Globe Theatre.
Detaining the man himself.
Whoa, you don't mean... Shakespeare in
there? Oh, yes.
To the Prince of Denmark.
Indeed, it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory.
David Tennant as Doctor Who and Hamlet in the RSC's recent production, which moves to London next month. After that, he'll start filming his final journeys in the TARDIS before handing over the sonic screwdriver to a new Doctor Who. But in between these two very demanding roles, the versatile young Scottish actor's been grappling with Einstein's general theory of relativity. Tennant stars in a new TV drama as the man who made Einstein famous. Arthur Eddington was a British astrophysicist whose experiments proved the validity of Einstein's ideas. What made their collaboration extraordinary was that it took place against the background of World War I. Eddington's attempts to champion the work of this obscure German scientist were met with huge resistance, not just because of the carnage on the battlefield, but also because his work threatened the very foundations of British science, as put forward by Isaac Newton.
He's suggesting that time is at different speeds in the universe, depending on how fast you are moving. The faster you move, the more time slows down.
Time isn't the same everywhere.
That's what he says. Yes, time isn't shared. It's not an absolute.
What are his references?
None, but...
Acknowledgements?
None.
Does he propose how any of this might be tested?
No, but that's not the point.
What is the point of theory if it can't be tested?
What does he say about gravity?
Nothing.
David Tennant in the BBC's new TV drama Einstein and Eddington. As a non-scientist, I'd never heard of Arthur Eddington until I watched this film. So when David Tennant magically appeared in the front row studio earlier, without the TARDIS, I wondered whether it was a name that he was familiar with.
No, I'd never heard of Arthur Stanley Eddington. I'd heard of Albert Einstein, as most of us have, I think. But I think that's why it's such a great drama, actually, that there's this incredible untold tale. You know, but for Eddington... proselytising for Einstein and indeed proving Einstein to be correct, the whole way we think about the universe could be many years behind where we're at now. It's incredibly important to everything that's come since this story, and I don't know why it's an untold story, really. And it may have something to do with Eddington himself, who wasn't a great self-publicist. I don't think he was rather a quiet, modest man. And then later on in life, you know, he's a very religious man. And as you see in the film, his Quaker beliefs and his pursuit of the truth is something that part of the reason that drove him on to see Einstein's theories through. But he spent a lot of his later life trying to marry his religious beliefs to his understanding of astrophysics, which became very unfashionable, you know, towards the end of his life. And that may, again, be part of the reason why he's not held in the esteem that he should be. I'm not sure, but it's... It's an incredible story.
I thought he was a fascinating character because there you have this Quaker who doesn't believe in war and yet has to live through two world wars.
Quite.
A repressed homosexual, a boffin who lives with his spinster sister and prepared to do something very, very brave, isn't he? He defies the government, the academic establishment, his university, everything for the sake of science.
He absolutely does, yes. And I think it is brave, incredibly brave what he did in the circumstances. You know, the First World War, when sort of anti-German feeling was probably the highest it's ever been, you know, and just this sense that if it's German, it must be evil. But I think it is his sort of purity of moral purpose that saw him through. I don't think he saw it as brave. I think he just saw it as the right thing to do and that he was morally obliged and spiritually obliged to follow the truth wherever it took him.
And personality-wise, the opposite of Einstein, isn't he? Who's this exuberant, eccentric, womanising, middle European Jew up against this uptight Englishman.
Quite. Yeah, quite. Yes, Einstein's all sort of... following one's urges and bare feet and unwashed, and Eddington's all sort of buttoned up and prim, and yet, you know, they needed each other so desperately in the set of circumstances that occurred. But it's, again, what makes it such a fascinating story, these two opposites propelling each other on without ever meeting either. I mean, eventually they meet and did meet after the events of the film, but... they were just corresponding through this whole time, never looked each other in the eye. They communicated really just through a sort of a bunch of calculations.
Obviously, in the film, you have to sound very knowledgeable about science. I mean, do you understand this stuff?
Of course I do. All of it. Yes. My. No, I mean, I have more of an understanding of the theory of relativity now than I did before I made the film. But it's still not an easy thing to entirely come to grips with. And in fact, even after the events of this film, astrophysicists were slightly cloudy about exactly what the theory of relativity was. There's quite a famous story that a very learned physicist came up to Einstein and came up to Eddington at a party and said, "I believe you're one of only three men who understand the theory of relativity." And Eddington said nothing. And he said, "Oh, come on, man, don't be shy." And he went, no, sorry, I wasn't being shy. I was just trying to figure out who the third one was. So I think it remains quite an opaque theory, quite difficult to get your head around. But it, ultimately, a sort of very beautiful theory. It's interesting, you hear physicists talking about the beauty of ideas, and that sort of pursuit of beauty is almost as important as the pursuit of the truth, because I think when the two come together, there's this great sense that the truth has been found.
Was Doctor Who in any way helpful in getting to grips with scientific lingo, do you think? Because, I mean, I remember you having to do this whole speech about prime numbers once.
Yes, well, there's a lot of science in Doctor Who, often very factual science and often slightly heightened science, and often bits that are just completely made up. But certainly that kind of integrity of purpose when you are talking about whatever it might be. Yeah, the Happy Prime speech in Doctor Who is a very good example. But that, you know, happy primes exist. That's a piece of actual science that we slipped in there. Yeah, you do have to develop a working understanding of what you're talking about, or at least have in your own head a version of what that truth might be. Because I think you've got to believe you know what you're talking about if you have the hope of convincing anybody else.
Now, soon after you filmed this, you started preparing for Hamlet and Love's Labour's Lost at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Since Hamlet is such a feat of memory, I'm interested in how you dealt with all these roles at once, and did you start learning the lines for Hamlet in advance?
I didn't know. I actually made a very conscious decision not to do too much on Hamlet in advance. We had 7 weeks rehearsal, which I decided should be long enough, really. I think there's a danger with something like Hamlet, which comes with so much baggage, so many preconceptions from everybody who comes to it, whether you're acting in it or just coming to see it as a member of the audience, that I think your job as an actor in those circumstances is to get rid of the baggage and treat it like it's just a play, like you would any other role. So I made a very conscious decision not to start learning it before the first day of rehearsals, so that, you know, any process of preparation and learning would happen along with rehearsals, and that would be informed by decisions being made in the rehearsal room and conversations being had there with the actors you're working with and with the director, rather than turning up on day one thinking, yes, my Hamlet's going to be a one-legged gentleman with a Danish accent or whatever it might be. I think it's trying to find what is fresh and real and, to use a slightly pretentious actually word, what is a sort of organic, to avoid the preconception and the sort of the weight of history on your shoulder when you come to something like that.
But there's still the mechanical process of having to learn lines. I mean, do you kind of write bits on post-it notes and stick them around the house?
Or occasionally. That's usually towards the end of the process, I find, when there's certain bits that aren't going in. Especially with Shakespeare, you know, you have to be very specific about the words you're saying because people tend to know them. But it's, you know, the learning lines thing is just, it does seem like a bit of alchemy to people who don't do it. But there really is no secret to it. It's just the boring bit. It's just homework. And there's no secret. Anyone can do it. It's not a skill that you learn. It's just about staring at words on a page until they're in your memory. It's just the boring bit, I'm afraid.
Now, Pete Postlethwaite was on this programme last night and he said that they had changed King Lear during the course of the current production. Have you changed Hamlet during the run?
Not in any fundamental way. We haven't re-rehearsed anything. I think inevitably with a long run of anything, and particularly with a play that is this rich and this ambiguous and this fecund, I think inevitably things change and progress and mature. But that's almost invisible to you, I think. It just sort of, you know, it kind of occurs to you in a different way every night, and that will be ongoing and things will... Yeah, I'm sure it has changed, but not... We didn't consciously redirect anything or change bits, no.
Do you feel haunted by the role of Hamlet? I'm just thinking Daniel Day-Lewis had to drop out of playing the role halfway through because he began to see his own dead father, and there have been many kind of stories like that. Do you feel like that?
It's interesting. Every night that you do it, it feels different. It is just so rich. There's so much of it, I suppose. There's so much story to tell every night that it takes you to different places. And some nights it can be terribly upsetting. Other nights it can be rather high, a sort of toxic energy it gives you. And it can be very different from night to night. It is very different from night to night. So sometimes I feel haunted by it. Sometimes I feel enlivened by it. Sometimes I feel weighted down with it. Sometimes you feel like it's a drug and you can't wait to take another sniff. So it's an extraordinary time. It's just big. There's just a lot of it. And it deals with some fairly fundamental emotions and situations. And it's an extraordinary thing to kind of keep hitting every night. I don't think I'd want to do it for too long. No, I think the run we've got is about right, because I think you do have to keep going to some quite dark places to summon up that stuff every night, yeah.
Now, when you finish the London run of Hamlet, you're going to start filming the final series of Doctor Who.
Well, my final bits, not the final. I suspect Doctor Who will go on for many years to come, yes.
How do you feel about that?
It's a mixture of emotions, really. It's sad because I love it and I will miss it. But at the same time, I think it's probably the right moment to move on. I think it's good to leave something when you're still enjoying it as much as I am. I don't want to outstay my welcome. You know, so it mixed emotions. I'm sure I'll be very sad when the day finally comes when I leave those studios in Cardiff for the last time.
Why did you decide to stop?
Just because if I didn't leave now, I never would, really. I have such a good time, and it would be very easy to stay forever. And I don't think that's good for the show or for me, probably. And I kind of thought I'd probably reach that tipping point where if I didn't go now, I never would. So it was difficult because it's hard to leave something that you love and that's going well and that people seem to be enjoying. But I'd rather go when there was a chance I might still be missed than to still be there when they're going, when is he leaving? Please, let's have someone else.
How do you cope with the fans?
They're all very nice people. It's not
difficult. It's a pretty fanatical following, isn't it?
It's certainly that there are some very enthusiastic fans, yeah. But usually it's a privilege to be in the middle of a show that is this.
Do they shout catchphrases
about.
At you in the street?
I don't really have catchphrases. I mean, there's a few things that the Doctor will repeat now and again, but it's not like.
But do people tell endless jokes about kind of sonic screwdrivers and TARDISes and things like that?
People do see "Where's your TARDIS?" with alarming regularity, and imagine that they're the first person who's ever said it. But you know, it's not the worst thing to have to cope with in life. It's not. It's a very privileged position to be in. To be part of something that people love as much as they seem to love Doctor Who is a wonderful kind of heady place to be. I'm aware that this is a time of my life that will probably, there's unlikely to be anything else that I'll do that will attract this particular kind of attention and this type of sort of cross-generational, cross-cultural enthusiasm, which is, you know, it's quite humbling, actually.
David Tennant and Einstein and Eddington is on the BBC Two tomorrow night at 9:10.